Unless otherwise indicated, Ratchet Book Club is intended for a mature audience. Viewer discretion is greatly advised. Ratchet Book Club, hood classics, good classics, Derek. You know, when I was younger, my full name was Derek DeGrate. DeGrate, because I am, and you're welcome. 916-633-1537. Ratchet and Ratchet at gmail.com. Ratchet Book Club on Twitter. Ratchet Book Club on Facebook. Yeah. I did some great sound effects in that last one, right? Don't get used to it. I will do the voice. Because that's the voice that I've had in my head for Conrad for like years, but the sound effects, that was the gift to accentuate what was going on. You're not going to hear the 3, 5, 7 at all in this show because it's not the cartel or anything stupid like that, but you won't hear a lot of gunshots either. I don't think. We'll see. I don't know. I love this book though. It's great, right? I know. You're welcome. Chapter 2. At Snow County Hospital, in the inspector father's waiting room, the inner door opens to a short corridor with the supply room to the left and a bathroom to the right. Fluorescent ceiling panels, white walls, and a white ceramic tile floor imply impeccable antibacterial procedures. I have seen that space because my child entered the world in the same maternity ward on another unforgettable night of incomparable chaos. On that stormy evening in 1974, where Richard Nixon gone home to California and Beezle on a rampage, my father found a nurse sprawled in the hallway, shot point blank. He remembers almost being driven to his knees by pity, by despair. The loss of Dr. McDonald, although terrible, had not fully penetrated Dad, for it had been so sudden, so dreamlike. Mere moments later, the sight of this dead nurse, young, fair, like a fallen angel in white raiment, golden hair fanning in a halo around her eerily serene face, pierced him, and he absorbed the truth and the meaning of both deaths at once. He tore open the storage closet door, searching for something he might use as a weapon. He found only spare linens, bottles of antiseptic cleaner, a locked cabinet of medications. Although in retrospect, this moment struck him as darkly comic, at the time he thought, with grave seriousness and with the logic of desperation, that having needed so much dough over the past few years, his hands were dangerously strong. If only he could get past Bezos' gun, he surely would have the strength to strangle him. No makeshift weapon could hope to be as deadly as the well-flexed hands of an angry baker. Sheer terror spawned this lunatic notion. Curiously, however, terror also gave him courage. The short hallway intersected a longer one, which led left and right. Off this new corridor, three doors served a pair of delivery rooms as well as the neonatal care unit, where swaddled newborns, each in his or her bassinet, pondered their new reality of light, shadow, hunger, discontent, and taxes. Dad sought my mother and me, but found only her. She lay in one of the delivery rooms, alone and unconscious on the birthing bed. At first, he thought that she must be dead. Darkness swooned at the edges of his vision, but before he passed out, he saw that his beloved Maddie was breathing. He clutched the edge of her bed until his vision brightened. Gray face, drenched with sweat, she looked not like the vibrant woman he knew, but instead appeared to be frail and vulnerable. Blood on the sheets suggested that she delivered their child, but no squalling infant was present. Elsewhere, Bezos shouted, "Where are you bastards?" Reluctant to leave my mother, Dad nevertheless went in search of the conflict to see what help he could provide. As he has always insisted, any baker would have done. In the second delivery room, he found Natalie Bezos upon another birthing bed. The slender aerialist had so recently died from the complications of childbirth that her tears of suffering had not yet dried upon her cheeks. According to Dad, even after her agony and even in death, she was ethereally beautiful. A flawless olive complexion, raven hair, her eyes were open, luminous green, like windows to a field in heaven. For Conrad Bezos, who didn't appear to be handsome under the grease paint, and who was not a man of substantial property, and whose personality would surely be at least somewhat off-putting, even under ordinary circumstances, this woman was a prize beyond all reasonable expectation. You could understand, though not excuse, his violent reaction to the loss of her. Stepping out of the delivery room, Dad came face to face with the homicidal clown. Simultaneously, Bezos flung open the door from the crochet and charged into the hall, a blanketed infant cradled in the crook of his left arm. At this close range, the pistol in his right hand appeared to be twice the size of that which it had been in the waiting room. As if they were in Alice's Wonderland, where objects grew or shrank with no regard for reason or for the laws of physics. Dad might have seized Bezos' wrists and, with his strong baker hands, fought for possession of the gun, but he dared not act in any way that would have put the baby at risk. With his pinched red face and furrowed brow, the infant appeared indignant, offended. Its mouth stretched open wide, as though it were trying to scream, but had been shocked silent by the realization that its father was a mad clown. "Thank God for the baby," Dad has often said. "Otherwise, I would have gotten myself killed. You would have grown up fatherless, and you'd have never learned how to make a first-rate creme brulee." So, cradling a baby and brandishing the pistol, Bezos demanded of my father, "Where are they, Rudy Tock?" "Where are who?" Dad asked. The red-eyed clown appeared to be both wrung by grief and ripped by anger. Tears streaked his makeup. His lips trembled as if he might sob uncontrollably, then skinned back from his teeth in an expression of such ferocity that a chill wound through Dad's bowels. "Don't play dumb," Bezos warned. "There had to have been other nurses. Maybe another doctor. I want the bastards dead. All of them who failed her." "They ran," my father said, certain that it would be safer to lie about having seen the medical staff escape than to insist that he encountered no one. "They slipped out behind your back, the way you came, through the waiting room. They're long gone." Feeding on his rage, Conrad Bezos appeared to swell larger, as if anger were the food of giants. No Barnum and Bailey buffoonery brightened his face, and the poisonous hatred in his eyes was as potent as cobra venom. Lest he become a stand-in for the medical staff no longer within Bezos' reach, Dad quickly added, with no trace of threat, as if only being helpful, "Police are on their way. They'll want to take the baby from you." "My son is mine," Bezos declared with such passion that the stink of stale cigarette smoke rising from his clothes might almost have been mistaken for the consequences of his fiery emotion. "I will do anything to keep him from being raised by the aerialists." Walking a thin line between clever manipulation and obvious fawning in the interest of self-preservation, my father said, "Your boy will be the greatest of his kind. Clown, jester, harlequin, jack muffin." "Jack pudding," the killer corrected, but without animosity. "Yes, he'll be the greatest. He will. I won't let anyone deny my son his destiny." With baby and pistol, Bezo pushed past my dad and hurried along the shorter hall, where he stepped over the dead nurse with no more concern for her than he would have shown for a janitor's mop and bucket. Feverishly trying to think of something he could do to bring down this brute without harming the infant, Dad could only watch in frustration. When Bezo reached the door to the expectant father's lounge, he hesitated, glanced back. "I'll never forget you, Rudy Tock. Never." My father could not decide whether that declaration might have been an expression of misguided sentimental affection or a threat. Bezo pushed through the door and disappeared. At once, Dad hurried back to the first delivery room because his primary concern understandably remained with my mother and me. Still unattended, my mother lay on the birthing bed where Dad had moments ago discovered her. Though still gray-faced and soaked with sweat, she had regained consciousness. She groaned with pain, blinked in confusion. Whether she was merely disoriented or delirious is a matter of contention between my parents. But my father insisted he feared for her when she said, "If you want Reuben sandwiches for dinner, we'll have to go to the market for cheese." Mom insisted she actually said, "After this, don't think you're ever going to touch me again, you son of a bitch." Their love is deeper than desire, than affection, than respect. So deep that its wellspring is humor. Humor is a petal on the flower of hope. And hope blossoms on the vine of faith. They have faith in each other, and faith that life has meaning. And from this faith comes their indefatigable good humor, which is their greatest gift to each other and to me. I grew up in a home filled with laughter. Regardless of what happens to me in the days ahead, I will have had the laughter and wonderful pastries. In this account of my life, I'll resort at every turn to amusement, for laughter is the perfect medicine for the tortured heart, the balm for misery, but I will not beguile you. I will not use laughter as a curtain to spare you the sight of horror and despair. We will laugh together, but sometimes the laughter will hurt. So, whether my mother was delirious or sound of mind, whether she blamed my father for the pain of labor or discussed the need for cheese, they are in relative agreement about what happened next. My father found a wall-mounted phone near the door and called for help. Because this device was more an intercom than a phone, it didn't have a standard keypad, just four keys, each clearly stating staffing, pharmacy, maintenance, security. Dad pressed security and informed the answering officer that people had been shot and that the assailant, costumed as a clown, was even then fleeing the building and that Maddie needed immediate medical assistance. From the bed, clear-headed now as if she had not been previous, my mother cried out, "Where's my baby?" Phone still to his ear, my father turned to her, astounded. Alarmed, "You don't know where it is?" Striving unsuccessfully to sit up, grimacing with pain, Mom said, "How would I know? I passed out or something. What do you mean someone was shot? For God's sake, who was shot? What's happening? Where's my baby?" Although the delivery room had no windows, although it was surrounded by hallways and by other rooms that further insulated it from the outside world, my folks heard faint sirens rising in the distance. Dad's memory regurgitated the suddenly nauseating image of Bezo in the hallway, the pistol in his right hand, the baby cradled in his left arm. Bitter acid burned in my father's throat, and his already harried heart raced faster. Perhaps Bezo's wife and child had died at birth. Perhaps the infant in his arms hadn't been his own, but had instead been little James or Jennifer Tock. "I thought kidnapped," Dad said when he recalls the moment. "I thought about the Lindbergh baby and Frank Sinatra Jr. being held for ransom and Rumpelstiltskin and Tarzan being raised by the apes. And though none of that makes sense, I thought it all in an instant. I wanted to scream, but I couldn't. And I felt just like that red-faced baby with his mouth open but silent. And when I thought of the baby, oh, then I just knew it had been you. Not his at all, but you, my Jimmy. Desperate now to find Bezo and stop him, Dad dropped the phone, bolted towards the open door to the hallway, and nearly collided with Charlene Coleman, a nurse who came bearing a baby in her arms. This infant had a broader face than the one Bezo had spirited into the stormy night. Its complexion was a healthy pink instead of a mottled red. According to Dad, its eyes shone clear and blue, and its face glowed with wonder. I hid with your baby, Charlene Coleman said. I hid from that awful man. I knew he would be in trouble when he first showed up with his wife, him wearing that ugly hat indoors and making no apology for it. I wish that I could verify from personal experience that, indeed, what alarmed Charlene from the get-go was not Bezo's clown makeup, not his poisonous ranting about his aerialist in-laws, not his eyes so crazy that they almost spun like pinwheels, but simply his hat. Unfortunately, less than 1 hour old, I had not yet learned English and had not even sorted out who all these people were. Chapter 3. Trembling with relief, Dad took me from Charlene Coleman and carried me to my mother. After the nurse raised the head of the birthing bed and provided more pillows, Mom was able to take me in her arms. Dad swears that her first words to me were these: "You better have been worth all the pain, little blue eyes, because if you turn out to be an ungrateful child, I'll make your life a living hell." Tearful, shaken by all that occurred, Charlene recounted recent events and explained how she had been able to spirit me to safety when the shooting started. Unexpectedly required to attend to two women simultaneously in urgent and difficult labor, Dr. McDonald had been unable at that hour to locate a qualified physician to assist on a timely basis. He divided his attention between the two patients, hurrying from one delivery room to the other, relying on his nurses for backup. His work complicated by the periodically dimming lights and worrying about whether the hospital generator would kick in reliably if the storm knocked out electric service. Natalie Bezo had received no prenatal care. She had unknowingly suffered from preeclampsia. During labor, she developed full-blown eclampsia and experienced violent convulsions that would not respond to treatment and that threatened not only her life, but the life of her unborn child. Meanwhile, my mother endured an excruciating labor, resulting largely from the failure of her cervix to dilate. IV injections of synthetic oxytocin initially did not induce sufficient contractions of the uterine muscles to allow her to squeeze me into the world. Natalie delivered first. Dr. McDonald tried everything to save her. An endotracheal tube to assist her breathing, injections of anticonvulsants, but soaring blood pressure and convulsions led to a massive cerebral hemorrhage that killed her. Even as the umbilical cord was tied off and cut between the Bezo baby and his dead mother, my mother, exhausted but still struggling to expel me, suddenly and at last experienced cervical dilation. The Jimmy Talk Show had begun. Before undertaking the depressing task of telling Conrad Bezo that he had gained a son and lost a wife, Dr. McDonald delivered me, and according to Charlene Coleman, announced that this solid little package would surely grow to be a football hero. Having successfully conveyed me from womb to wider world, my mother promptly passed out. She didn't hear the doctor's prediction and didn't see my broad, pink, wonder-filled face until my protector, Charlene, returned and presented me to my father. After Dr. McDonald had given me to Nurse Coleman to be swabbed and then wrapped in a white cotton receiving cloth, and when he had satisfied himself that my mother had merely fainted and that she would come to herself in moments, with or without smelling salts, he peeled off his latex gloves, pulled down a surgical mask, and went to the expectant father's lounge to console Conrad Bezo as best he could. Almost at once, the shouting started, bitter, accusatory words, paranoid accusations, the vilest language delivered in the most furious voice imaginable. Even in the usually serene, well-soundproof delivery room, Nurse Coleman heard the uproar. She understood the tenor, if not the specifics, of Conrad Beazle's reaction to the loss of his wife. When she left the delivery room and stepped into the hallway to hear Beazle more clearly, intuition told her to carry me with her, bundled in a thin blanket. In the hall, she encountered Lois Hansen, another nurse, who had in her arms the Beazle baby. Lois, too, had ventured forth to hear the clown's intemperate outburst. Lois made a fatal mistake. Against Charlene's advice, she moved towards the closed door to the waiting room, believing that the sight of his infant son would quench Beazle's hot anger and ameliorate the intense grief from which his rage had flared. Herself a refugee from an abusive husband, Charlene had little faith that the grace of fatherhood would temper the fury of any man who, even in a moment of profound loss, responded first and at once with rage and with threats of violence, rather than with tears or shock or denial. Besides, she remembered his hat, worn indoors with no regard for manners. Charlene sensed trouble coming. Big trouble. She retreated with me along the maternity ward's internal hall to the neonatal care unit. As that door was swinging shut behind us, she heard the gunshot that killed Dr. McDonald. This room contained rows of bassinets in which newborns were nestled, most dreaming, a few cooing, none yet crying. An enormous view window occupied the better part of one long wall, but no proud fathers or grandparents were currently standing on the other side of it. With the infants were two crochet nurses. They had heard the shouting, then the shot, and they are more receptive to Charlene's advice than Lois had been. Presciently, Nurse Coleman assured them that the gunman wouldn't hurt the babies, but warned he would surely kill every member of the hospital staff that he could find. Nevertheless, before fleeing, each nurse scooped up an infant and fretted about those they were forced to leave behind. Frightened by a second shot, they followed Charlene through a door beside the view window, out of the maternity ward into the main corridor. The three, with their charges, took refuge in a room where an elderly man slept on unaware. A low wattage nightlight did little to press back the gloom, and the flickering storm at the window only made the shadows jitter with insectile energy. Quiet, hardly daring to breathe, the three nurses huddled together until Charlene heard sirens in the distance. This welcome wail drew her to the window, which provided a view of the parking lot in front of the hospital. She hoped to see police cars. Instead, from that second story room, she saw Beazle with his baby, crossing the rain-washed blacktop. He looked, she said, like a figure in a foul dream, scuttling and strange, like something you might see on the night that the world ended and cracks open in the foundations of the earth to let loose the angry legions of the damned. Charlene is a transplanted Mississippian and a Baptist whose soul is filled with the poetry of the South. Beazle had parked to such a distance that through the screen of rain and under the yellow pall of the sodium vapor lamps, the make, model, and true color of his car could not be discerned. Charlene watched him drive away, hoping the police would intercept him before he reached a nearby county road, but his taillights dwindled into the drizzling darkness. With the threat removed, she returned to the delivery room just as Dad's thoughts were flashed from the Lindbergh baby tragedy to Rumpelstiltskin to Tarzan raised by apes, in time to assure him that I had not been kidnapped by a homicidal clown. Later, my father would confirm that the minute of my birth, my length, and my weight precisely fulfilled the predictions made by my grandfather on his deathbed. His first proof, however, that the events in the intensive care unit were not just extraordinary but supernatural, came when, as my mother held me, he folded back the receiving blanket, exposing my feet, and found that my toes were fused as Joseph had predicted. "Syndactyly," Dad said. "It could be fixed," Charlene assured him. Then her eyes widened with surprise. "How do you know such a doctorish word?" My father only repeated, syndactyly, as he gently, lovingly, and with amazement, fingered my fused toes. Chapter 4. Syndactyly is not merely the name of the affliction with which I was born, but also the theme of my life for 30 years now. Things often prove to be fused in unanticipated ways. Moments separated by many years are unexpectedly joined, as if the space-time continuum has been folded by some power with either a peculiar sense of humor or an agenda arguably worthwhile but so complex as to be mystifying. People unknown to one another discover that they are bonded by fate as completely as two toes sharing a single sheath of skin. Surgeons repaired my feet so long ago that I have no slightest memory of the procedures. I walk. I run when I must. I dance, but not so well. With all due respect for the memory of Dr. Ferris McDonald, I never became a football hero, and I never wish to be one. My family has never had an interest in sports. We're fans instead of puffs, eclairs, tarts, torts, cakes, trifles, and fans as well of the infamous cheese and broccoli pies and the Reuben sandwiches and all the fabulous dishes of table-cracking weight that my mother produces. We will trade the thrills and glory of all the games and tournaments mankind has ever invented for a dinner together and for the conversation and the laughter that runs like a fast tide from the unfolding of our napkins to the final sip of coffee. Over the years, I've grown from 20 inches to 6 feet. My weight has increased from 8 pounds 10 ounces to 188 pounds, which should prove my contention that I'm at most husky, not as large as I appear to be for most people. The fifth of my grandfather's 10 predictions, that everyone would call me Jimmy, has also proved true. Even on first meeting me, people seem to think that James is too formal to fit and that Jim is too earnest or otherwise inappropriate. Even if I introduce myself as James, and with emphasis, they at once begin addressing me as Jimmy, with complete comfort and familiarity, as though they've known me since my face was postpartum pink and my toes were fused. As I make these tape recordings with the hope that I may survive to transcribe and edit them, I've lived through 4 of the 5 terrible days about which Grandpa Joseph warned my father. They were terrible both in the same and in different ways, each day filled with the unexpected and with terror, some marked by tragedy, but they were days filled with much else as well. Much else. And now, one more to go. My dad, my mom, and I spent 20 years pretending that the accuracy of Joseph's first 5 predictions did not necessarily mean that the next 5 would be fulfilled. My childhood and teenage years passed uneventfully, presenting no evidence whatsoever that my life was a yo-yo on the string of fate. Nonetheless, as the first of those 5 days relentlessly approached, Thursday, September 5th, 1994, we worried. Mom's coffee consumption went from 10 cups a day to 20. She has a curious relationship with caffeine. Instead of fraying her nerves, the brew soothes them. If she fails to drink her usual 3 cups during the morning, by noon she'll be as fidgety as a frustrated fly buzzing against a window pane. If she doesn't pour down 8 by bedtime, she lies awake, so mentally active that she not only counts sheep by the thousand, but also names them and develops an elaborate life story for each. Dad believes that Maddie's topsy-turvy metabolism is a direct result of the fact that her father was a long-haul trucker who ate no-dose caffeine tablets as if they were candy. Maybe so, Mom sometimes answers my father, but what are you complaining about? When we were dating, all you had to do was get 5 or 6 cheap coffees into me, and I was as pliable as a rubber band. As September 15, 1994 drew near, my father's worry expressed itself in fallen cakes, curdled custard, rubbery pie crusts, and creme brulee that had a sandy texture. He could not concentrate on his recipes or his ovens. I believe that I handled the anticipation reasonably well. In the last 2 days leading up to the first of those 5 ominous dates, I might have walked into more closed doors than usual. I might have tripped more often than is customary for me when climbing the stairs. And I do admit to dropping a hammer on Grandma Rowena's foot while trying to hang a picture for her. But it was her foot, not her head. And the one instant when a trip led to a fall, Ollie tumbled down a single flight of steps and didn't break anything. Our worry was kept somewhat in check by the fact that Grandpa Joseph had given Dad 5 terrible days in my life. Not just one. Obviously, regardless of how grim September 15th might be, I would not die on that day. Yes, but there's always a possibility of severed limbs and mutilation, Grandma Rowena cautioned, and paralysis and brain damage. She's a sweet woman, my maternal grandmother, but one with too sharp a sense of the fragility of life. As a child, I had dreaded those occasions when she insisted on reading me to sleep. Even when she didn't revise the classic stories, which she often did, even when the big bad wolf was defeated, as he should have been, Grandma paused at key points in the narrative to muse aloud on the many gruesome things that might have happened to the 3 little pigs if their defenses had not held, or if their strategies had proved faulty. Being ground up for sausages was the least of it. And so, less than 6 weeks after my 20th birthday, came the first of my 5 ordeals. Part 2. Might as well die if I can't fly. Chapter 5. At 9 o'clock on the evening of Wednesday, September 14th, my parents and I met in their dining room to have as heavy a dinner as we might be able to stand up from without our knees buckling. We also gathered to discuss once more the wisest strategies for getting through the fateful day that lay just 3 hours ahead of me. We hoped that in a prepared and cautious state of mind, I might reach September 16th as unscathed as the 3 little pigs after their encounter with the wolf. Grandma Rowena joined us to speak from the point of view of the wolf. That is, she'll play the devil's advocate and relate to us which flaws she saw in our precautions. As always, we took dinner on gold-rimmed Reynard Limoges china, using sterling silver flatware by Bucalati. In spite of what the table setting suggests, my parents are not wealthy, just securely middle class. Although my father makes a fine salary as a pastry chef, stock options and corporate jets don't come with this position. My mother earns a modest income working part-time from home, painting pet portraits on commission. Mostly cats and dogs, but also rabbits, parakeets, and once a milk snake that came to pose and didn't want to leave. Their small Victorian house would be called humble if it wasn't so cozy that it felt sumptuous. The ceilings are not high, and the proportions of the room are not grand, but they have been furnished with great care and with an eye to comfort. You can't blame Earl for taking refuge behind the living room sofa, under the clawfoot tub in the upstairs bath, in a clothes hamper, in the pantry potato basket, and elsewhere during the 3 interesting weeks that he adopted us. Earl was a milk snake. And the home from which he came was a sterile place with stainless steel and black leather furniture, abstract art, and cactuses for houseplants. Of all the charming corners in a small house where you might read a book, listen to music, or gaze out of a many-paned window at a bejeweled winter day, none is as welcoming as the dining room. This is because to the Tock family, food, and the conviviality that marks our every meal, is the hub that turns the spokes that spins the wheel of life. Therefore, the luxury of Limoges and Bucalati. Considering that we're incapable of pulling a chair up to any dinner with less than 5 courses, and that we regard the first 4 in which we fully indulge as mere preparation for the 5th, it's miraculous that none of us are overweight. Dad once discovered that his best wool suit had grown tight in the waist. He merely skipped lunch 3 days, and the pants were then loose on him. Mom's caffeine tolerance is not the most significant curiosity regarding our unusual relationship to food. Both sides of the family, the Tock side and the Greenwich side. Or is it Greenwich? I don't know. Greenwich being my mother's maiden name, had metabolisms as efficient as that of a hummingbird. A creature that can eat 3 times its body weight each day and remain light enough to fly. Mom once suggested that she and my father had been instantly attracted to each other, in part because of a subliminal perception that they were metabolic royalty. The dining room features a coffered mahogany ceiling, mahogany wainscoting, and a mahogany floor. Silk moire walls and a Persian carpet soften all the wood. There is a blown glass chandelier with pendant crystals, but dinner is always served by candlelight. On this special night in September of 1994, the candles were numerous and squat, set in small but not shallow cut crystal bowls, some clear and others ruby red, which fractured the light into soft prismatic patterns on the linen tablecloth, on the walls, and on our faces. Candles were placed not only on the table, but also on the sideboards. Had you glanced in through a window, you might have thought not that we were at dinner, but that we were conducting a seance, with food provided to keep us entertained until at last the ghost showed up. Although my parents had prepared my favorite dishes, I tried not to think of it as a condemned man's last meal. 5 properly presented courses cannot be eaten on the same schedule as a McDonald's Happy Meal, especially not with carefully chosen wines. We were prepared for a long evening together. Dad is the head pastry chef for the world-famous Snow Village Resort, a position he inherited from his father, Joseph. Because all breads and pastries must be fresh each day, he goes to work at 1 o'clock in the morning, at least 5 and often 6 days a week. By 8, with the baking for the entire day complete, he comes home for breakfast with Mom, then sleeps until 3 in the afternoon. That September, I also worked those hours because I had been an apprentice baker for 2 years at the same resort. The Tock family believes in nepotism. Dad says it's not really nepotism if your talent is real. Give me a good oven and I'm a wicked competitor. It's funny, but I'm never clumsy in a kitchen. When baking, I'm Gene Kelly. I'm Fred Astaire. I'm grace personified. Dad would be going from our late dinner to work, but I would not. In preparation for the first of the 5 days in Grandpa Joseph's prediction, I had taken a week's vacation. Our starter course was soup burek, an Armenian dish. Numerous paper-thin layers of pasta are separated by equally thin layers of butter and cheese, finished with a golden crust. You know, I read this book when I was like 20, maybe a little bit older, maybe a little bit younger, I don't know. But now that I'm an adult, like a full-blown adult, and I can actually make it to a lot of these places without having to ask people, I'm going to find a place out here to make soup burek, and I'm going to try it. Because back then it sounded great, and now it sounds great. It was never one of them moments where it was like, it doesn't sound right. This sounds fantastic, and I want it in my face. I still lived with my folks in those days, so Dad said, you should stay home from midnight to midnight. Hide out, nap, read, watch a little TV. Then what'll happen, Grandma Rowena imagined, is that he'll fall down the stairs and break his neck. Don't use the stairs, Mom advised. Stay in your room, honey. I can bring your meals to you. So then the house will burn down, Rowena said. Now, Weena, the house won't burn down, Dad assured her. The electrical wiring is sound. The furnace is brand new. Both fireplace chimneys were recently cleaned. There's a grounded lightning rod on the roof, and Jimmy doesn't play with matches. Rowena was 77 in 1994, 24 years a widow and past her grief, a happy woman but opinionated. She had been asked to play the devil's advocate, and she was adamant in her role. If not a fire, then a gas explosion, she declared. Gee, I don't want to be responsible for destroying the house, I said. Weena, Dad reasoned, there hasn't been a house-destroying gas explosion in the entire history of Snow Village. So an airliner will crash into the place. Oh, and that happens weekly around here, my father said. It's the first time for everything, Rowena asserted. If there's a first time for an airliner to crash into our house, then there's a first time for vampires moving next door, but I'm not going to start wearing a garlic necklace. If not an airliner, one of those Federal Express planes full of packages, Rowena said. Dad gaped at her, shook his head. Federal Express. Mom interpreted, what mother means is that surely if fate has something planned for our Jimmy, he can't hide from it. Fate is fate. It'll find him. Maybe a United Parcel Service plane, said Rowena. Over steaming bowls of pureed cauliflower soup, enlivened with white beans and tarragon, we agreed that the wisest course for me would be to proceed as if I would on any ordinary day off work, though always with caution. On the other hand, Grandma Rowena said, caution could get him killed. Now, Weena, how could caution get a person killed, my father wondered. Grandma finished a spoonful of soup and smacked her lips as she had never done until she turned 75, 2 years previously. She smacked them with relish repeatedly. Halfway between her 7th and 8th decades, she had decided that longevity had earned her the right to indulge in certain small pleasures that she had never previously allowed herself. These were pretty much limited to smacking her lips, blowing her nose as noisily as she wished, though never at the table, and leaving her spoon and or fork turned useful side up on the plate at the end of each course, instead of useful side down as her mother, a true Victorian and a stickler for etiquette, had instructed her to always do in order to properly indicate that she had finished. She smacked her lips again and explained why caution could be dangerous. Say Jimmy's going across the street, but he worries that a bus might hit him. Or a garbage truck, Mom suggested. Those great lumbering things on those hilly streets, why, if the brakes let go, what's to stop them? They go right through a house. Bus, garbage truck, it might even be a speeding hearse, Grandma allowed. What reason would a hearse have to speed, Dad asked. Speeding or not, if it was a hearse, said Grandma, wouldn't that be ironic? Run down by a hearse? God knows, life is often ironic in a way that it's never shown on television. The viewing public could never handle it, Mom said. Their capacity for genuine irony is exhausted halfway through an episode of Murder, She Wrote. What passes for irony on TV these days, my dad noted, is just poor plotting. I said, I'm less spooked by garbage trucks than by those huge concrete mixers that drive to construction sites. I'm always sure the part that revolved is suddenly going to work loose of the truck, roll down the street, and flatten me. All right, Grandma Rowena said. So it's a concrete mixer Jimmy's afraid of meeting up with. Not afraid exactly, I said. Just leery. So he stands on the sidewalk, looks left, then looks right, then he looks left again, being cautious, taking his time. And because he delays there on the curb too long, he's hit by a falling safe. In the interest of healthy debate, my father was willing to entertain some rather exotic speculations. But this stretched his patience too far. A falling safe? Where would it fall from? From a tall building, of course, Grandma said. There aren't any tall buildings in the Snow Village, Dad gently protested. Rudy, dear, Mom said, I think you're forgetting the Alpine Hotel. That's only 4 stories. A safe drop 4 stories would obliterate Jimmy, Grandma insisted. To me, in a concerned tone, she said, I'm sorry, is this upsetting you, sweetheart? Not at all, Grandma. It's the simple truth, I'm afraid. I know, Grandma. It would obliterate you. Totally, I agreed. But it's such a final word, obliterate. It sure does focus the mind. I should have thought before I spoke. I should have said crushed. In lambent red candlelight, Weena had a Mona Lisa smile. I reached across the table and patted her hand. Being a pastry chef, required to mix many ingredients in precise measure, my father has a greater respect for mathematics and reason than do my mother and grandmother, who are more artistic in their temperaments and less slavishly devoted to logic than he is. Why? He asked. Would anyone raise a safe to the top of the Alpine Hotel? Well, of course, to keep their valuables in, said Grandma. Whose valuables? The hotel's valuables. Although Dad never triumphs in exchanges of this nature, he always remains hopeful that if he only persists, reason will prevail. Why, he asked, wouldn't they put a big heavy safe on the ground floor? Why go to all of the trouble of craning it to the roof? My mother said, because no doubt their valuables were on the top floor. In moments like these, I have never been quite sure if Mom shares more than a little of Weena's cockeyed perspective on the world, or if she's just playing with my father. Her face is guileless. Her eyes are never evasive and always limpid. She is by nature a straightforward woman. Her emotions are too clear for misinterpretation, and her intentions are never ambiguous. Yet, as Dad says, for a person so admirably open and direct by nature, she can turn inscrutable when it tickles her to, just as easily as throwing a light switch. It's one of the things he loves about her. Our conversation continued through an endive salad with pears, walnuts, and crumbled blue cheese, followed by filet mignon on a bed of potato and onion pancakes with asparagus on the side. Before Dad got up to roll the dessert cart in from the kitchen, we had agreed that for the momentous day ahead, I should keep to my usual vacation routine. With caution. But not too much caution. Midnight arrived. September 15th began. Nothing happened right away. Maybe nothing will, Mom said. Something will, Grandma disagreed and smacked her lips. Something will. If I had not been obliterated or even badly crushed by 9 o'clock the next evening, we will meet here for dinner again. Together, we will break bread while remaining alert for the whiff of natural gas and the drone of a descending airliner. Now, after demi-dessert, followed by a full dessert, followed by petite fours, all accompanied by oceans of coffee, Dad went off to work and I helped with the kitchen cleanup. Petite four, for those of y'all who are like me and finally have a dictionary to look this stuff up attached to your book, is a very small fancy cake, cookie, or confection, typically made with marzipan and traditionally served after a meal. The origin, as we know, is French, and it's literally little oven. Then at 1:30 in the morning, I retired to the living room to read a new book for which I had high expectations. I have a great fondness for murder mysteries. On the first page, a victim was found chopped up and packed in a trunk. His name was Jim. I put that book aside, selected another from the stack on the coffee table, and returned to my armchair. A beautiful dead blonde stared from the book jacket, strangled with an antique Japanese obi knotted colorfully around her throat. The first victim was named Dolores. With a sigh of contentment, I settled down in my chair. Grandma sat on the sofa, busy with a needlepoint pillow. She had been a master of decorative stitching since her teenage years. Since she had moved in with Mom and Dad almost 2 decades ago, she had kept baker's hours, sewing elaborate patterns through the night. My mother and I kept that schedule too. Mom had homeschooled me because our family lived by night. Recently, Grandma's preferred embroidery motifs were insects. Her butterfly wall hanging and even her ladybug chair cushions were charming, but I didn't care for the spider festoon anima cars on my armchair or for the cockroach pillow. In an adjacent alcove, which Mom had outfitted as her studio, she worked happily on a pet portrait. The subject was a glittery-eyed Gila monster named Killer. Because Killer was hostile toward strangers and was not housebroken, the proud owners had provided a series of photos from which Mom could work. A hissing, biting, pooping Gila monster could really spoil an otherwise pleasant evening. The living room is small, and the shallow art alcove is separated from it only by silk curtains and a wide archway. The curtains were open, so Mom could keep an eye on me and be ready to move fast in case she recognized, say, signs of impending spontaneous human combustion. For perhaps an hour, we were silent, immersed in our various pursuits, and then Mom said, "Sometimes I worry that we're becoming the Addams Family." The initial 8 hours of my first terrible day passed without a disturbing incident. At 8:15, his eyebrows white with flour, Dad came home from work. I couldn't make a good creme plombiers to save my ass. I'll be glad when we've got through this day and I can focus again. We had breakfast together at the kitchen table. By 9 a.m., after more than the usual day's end hugs, we went to our bedrooms and hid beneath the sheets. Perhaps the rest of my family wasn't hiding, but I pretty much was. I believed in my grandfather's predictions more than I cared to admit to the rest of them, and my nerves tightened with each tick of the clock. Going to bed in the hour when most people are starting to begin their workday, I require blackout blinds overlaid by heavy drapes that absorb both light and sound. My room was quiet and dead black. After a few minutes, I needed urgently to turn on a bedside lamp. Not since early childhood had I been this disturbed by the dark. From my nightstand drawer, I withdrew a plastic sleeve in which was preserved the free pass to the circus that Officer Huey Foster had given to my father more than 20 years ago. The 3x5 card appeared newly printed, marked only by the crease through the middle where Dad had folded it to fit in his wallet. On the blank reverse, Dad had taken dictation from Joseph on his deathbed. The five dates. The front of the pass featured lions and elephants. Admit to, it directed in black letters, and in red blazed a promise, free. Towards the bottom were four words that I read uncounted times over the years. Prepare to be enchanted. Depending on my mood, sometimes that sentence seemed to betoken forthcoming adventure and wonder. At other times, I drew from it a more threatening interpretation. Prepare to be scared shitless. After returning the pass to the drawer, I lay awake for a while. I didn't think I would sleep. Then I slept. 3 hours later, I sat up in bed, instantly awake and alert, trembling with fear. To the best of my knowledge, I hadn't been awakened by a bad dream. No nightmare images lingered in memory. Nonetheless, I woke with a completely formed and terrifying thought so oppressive that my heart felt as if it were being squeezed in a vise, and I could draw only quick, shallow breaths. If there were to be 5 terrible days in my life, I would not die on this one. In her inimitable way, however, Weena had pointed out that an exemption from death this September did not rule out severed limbs, mutilation, paralysis, and brain damage. Neither could I rule out the death of someone else, someone dear to me, my father, my mother, my grandmother. If this were to be a terrible day because one of them will suffer a painful and violent death that would haunt me for the rest of my life, then I might wish that I was the one who had died. I sat on the edge of the bed, glad that I had gone to sleep with the nightstand lamp aglow. My hands were slick with sweat, and shaking so badly that I might not have been able either to find the switch or to turn it. A close and loving family is a blessing, but the more people we love and the more deeply we love them, the more vulnerable we are to loss and grief and loneliness. I was finished with sleep. The bedside clock reported 1:30 p.m. Less than half the day remained, only 10.5 hours till midnight. In that time, however, a life could be taken, a world could end, and hope. 916-633-1537, wretchedandratchet@gmail.com, Ratchet Book Club on Twitter, Ratchet Book Club on Facebook. You can leave a review on Spotify. It takes like 13 seconds. You can also leave a review on Podchaser. Copy and paste that into Apple Podcasts, and then copy and paste that into the Good Pods app. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/singlesimulcast. $1 will get you a ton of content. You can also donate to the show at buymeacoffee.com/sscast or on the Good Pods app. You can leave a tip in the tip jar. Thank you so much for listening. I greatly appreciate it. Y'all be good. I'm going to holler at you later. Peace. Intro and outro to Ratchet Book Club is by That Kid Garan, and it's called Goodbyes. You can email him at tkgbeats94@gmail.com for more information on how to lease this beat.
This is Single Simulcast.